Thanks for tuning in for the Book Club at 91.7 on this Saturday morning here on WVXU and WMUB. I'm Mark Purcell. On the phone with me is Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, that best-selling book in its 10th anniversary edition, out now. It includes a new afterword by the author. Michael, welcome again to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thank you. Good to be back.
So, 10 years later, did you believe that The Omnivore's Dilemma would be still plaguing your existence here a decade later?
No, when I wrote this book, the idea that it would still be in print for 10 years and would have the impact it's had would never occur to me. I really, I'm as surprised as anyone. But you know, sometimes your topic and your obsession at the moment happens to coincide with a cultural wave that's breaking, and I think that that's what happened in this case. I think that the question that was occupying me in working on the book, which is, you know, this very simple question is, where does our food come from, has become a question shared by millions of people in our culture. And I think that that's what continues to draw people to the book, that we're very confused about our eating. We do have dilemmas of many kinds, whether it's about health or morality or ethics or the environment. And we've come to realize that our eating is one of the most important things we do, both in terms of our health and the health of the planet. And so looking for somebody to guide you through those dilemmas, I think, and there I was trying to do the best job I could on those very hard questions.
Well, I'm curious, and I, you know, when I realized this was the 10th anniversary of The Omnivore's Dilemma, I thought, well, gosh, everything has improved so much, but does our awareness of those dilemmas we face as eaters and consumers increase that anxiety more in these days?
Well, I'm afraid that it has. I think people, you know, a little information can be a scary thing for people, and that people know that they should pay attention to how their food is produced, and they have lots of questions about chemicals in the food or genetically modified food or whatever it is, with the result that I think that people are probably more anxious than ever. And I hate to think I've contributed to that, because I've also tried to show people that there are really good alternatives and that eating needn't be complicated. And I reduced everything I'd learned about how to eat to 7 words: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And that really is all you need to know. But it, obviously, there are complications in unpacking, well, what does that mean to eat food? Because there's a lot of stuff out there that isn't food that we do eat. But on the other hand, I think on balance, it's very healthy. And the fact that consumers are asking this question, where does my food come from, how is it produced, has put enormous pressure on the food industry. And you see them changing. They are reformulating foods right and left to remove things like high fructose corn syrup, to remove synthetic chemicals and colorings, to simplify their ingredient list. Look how many companies boast about how few ingredients they have in their processed food products. And also to change the kinds of animals they use in their food, to remove antibiotics from chicken production, or to feature pork grown from pigs that actually got to go outside during their lives at one point. So all that, I think, is very positive, and I think that there is real movement. I think at the same time, you see this alternative food economy that is growing by leaps and bounds, and, you know, is probably worth by now, I don't know, $50 or $75 billion. It's still small compared to the mainstream food economy, but it's growing and it's putting pressure on the mainstream food economy. So there are lots of reasons to be hopeful, and also there are alternatives. If you don't like to eat feedlot meat, which, you know, my research in Omnivore's Dilemma made me decide I could not in all good conscience eat, there are really good alternatives. I can now find, I was just in a normal conventional supermarket, not a Whole Foods, in Kent, Connecticut, and there was grass-fed hamburger. You would not have seen that 10 years ago. So the organic market is growing, and there's a lot more access to, you know, high-quality organic food. Pastured eggs is a category you now see that you never saw a few years ago. So in some ways, it's the best of times and the worst of times, because the mainstream food industry is still doing pretty much what it was doing. But I do see signs of change, and I'm very encouraged by what I see.
The Omnivore's Dilemma, a natural history in four meals, celebrating its 10th anniversary. Here, speaking with Michael Pollan here on the Book Club at 91.7. And I wondered about that, you know, with how organic foods are spreading. Let's just say I found a package of grass-fed Angus beef in a very small town in the mountains of North Carolina. That's how much that has spread, where you usually wouldn't find specialty foods like that.
Yeah.
But with the price for organic foods coming down and that trend for organic foods, now big foods beginning to jump on the bandwagon, how much do we have to fear from that?
Well, you know, some people are very troubled when they see conventional companies get into the organic business. And I understand that small farmers sometimes get hurt by that. But on balance, that's how change comes. You know, you have this challenge arise from the margins, and we don't have revolutions in this country normally. We basically have the mainstream co-opting those challenges and realizing, hey, there's a market here. Let's buy that company. And that's really how innovation comes to food. You have all these small, innovative food companies, artisanal food companies, developing new products, and then the big guys come along and gobble them up. But over time, that does lead to change, and so I don't deplore that kind of thing. I just think that realistically, you know, it's funny. I often ask audiences, "How would you feel if McDonald's went organic and had only grass-fed beef and organic potatoes and no high fructose corn syrup?" And they always moan. They go, "Oh, that's not what they want to see. They want to see a new McDonald's, you know, founded on healthy food and a whole different set of values." And I understand that because the food movement is a communitarian movement, really. It wants to see new social forms, new economic forms. On the other hand, think what an environmental victory that would be and what a victory for the animals that would be if a company as big as McDonald's changed like that. You know, think of all the cornfields that wouldn't be sprayed with atrazine or all the animals that wouldn't have to have these miserable lives. So I think I'd have to take that and call it a victory rather than deplore it.
I'm curious when it comes to, you know, when we ask the question, where does my food come from these days? It's all the farm to table movement and the shorter distance, both for the environment and many other purposes. I'm curious, has that actually shrunk?
The local food movement has been extremely positive on many levels. You know, every city in America now, I do a lot of traveling and a lot of public speaking, and every city in America, there is at least one really good farm-to-table restaurant. The importance of that is not only that people get access to this delicious local food, which is often fresher and picked at the, you know, maximum ripeness, but they're also supporting farmers in their community. They're keeping them alive, and they're meeting those farmers. You know, local food does this wonderful social thing, which is put urbanites in contact with farmers, two groups that haven't been speaking in America for decades. And the urbanite is informed and the farmer is informed by that exchange. And it also keeps land open that might otherwise be developed. So I think the local food movement, which is vibrant everywhere in this country right now, you know, we're up to something like 8,000 farmers markets, and it was around 4,000, I think, when I wrote the book. This is a very healthy development. I mean, farmers markets are not ideal for farmers because they have to spend too much time off their farm. It's true. On the other hand, there is this wonderful cultural exchange that takes place. People learn about new foods. Children learn where their food comes from. You know, farmers markets have become the new public square in America. People go there to, you know, with their political petitions, there are people playing music, you get a massage, at least in California. And people go to the farmer's market even if they don't need to buy food, because it's just kind of a very nice place to hang out. And it does what a public square has always done, which has allowed very different kinds of people to mix. There was a study done a couple years ago that you have 10 times more conversations at the farmer's market than you do at the supermarket. The supermarket is not a social experience because everybody is trained to, you know, follow in the same order. You know, I mean, everyone goes counterclockwise or clockwise, and so you don't bump into people. And it's, you know, there's music and it's cold and it's a very solitary experience. But marketing in the history of humanity has been this wonderful social event, and that's coming back. So that's another thing local food is doing that has nothing to do with the food itself.
I'm speaking with Michael Pollan, the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, a natural history in four meals, now out in its 10th anniversary edition with a new afterword by the author. His most recent book was Cooked, The Natural History of Transformation. Details of Michael's work and these books on our website, wvxu.org. I wanted to ask, about the people that you interacted with in the Omnivore's Dilemma here a decade later, especially the Salatin Farm, and how Joel and the farm are doing here 10 years later.
Joel is like now an international farmer celebrity. It's kind of remarkable what's happened to him and his farm. I think last time they had, they would do this open day for their customers and other people to visit the farm every other August. And the last time they did it, they had 2,000 or 3,000 people show up. And they actually have had to stop it because the farm gets kind of trampled. He's out there speaking. And if you ever have the opportunity to hear Joel Salatin give a speech, run, do not walk. He's just a fantastic and hilarious and moving speaker. And he has this wonderful slideshow about his farm. So, and Joel's influence has also spread. He does a lot of consulting and speaks at farmer workshops. And there are now, I would say, it may be hundreds, but certainly dozens of farms modeled on Joel's. And you can find that kind of radically diversified animal farm in every corner of the country. These are farms where the animals are rotated through pastures, and they're solar-based farms in that the grass collects the solar energy, feeds the animals, the waste of one animal becomes the food of the next animal, and the whole system is this beautiful ecological dance that he orchestrates. And the result is very high-quality food from remarkably happy animals and a pretty good living for the farmer. And so we're seeing that. I've been to Salatin-esque farms in the American South, in California, in the Northwest, in the Northeast, and in the Midwest. They're just popping up everywhere. And they're called polyculture farms or sometimes permaculture farms. And they're worth seeking out, just because it's such a sustainable system and the quality of the food tends to be quite good.
Well, in the new afterword, you note many things that have changed since the original publication of The Omnivore's Dilemma, but you also note some things don't change, that the conquest of corn continues.
Yeah. Well, the sad thing is 10 years later, the book is still relevant in its indictment of the industrial food system, and that we still have a food system that is substantially based on too few crops, namely corn and soybeans, the corn's partner in the field in many places, and that we're still growing too much grain and feeding it to animals, some of whom are not evolved to digest grain very well, like cows, and that the corn crop is actually bigger than it was when I wrote the book. And when I wrote the book, I was talking about how we have a very precarious food system now because it depends on this one crop to a remarkable extent. Corn is in the, animal feed, obviously, so we eat corn indirectly through these animals we eat. Corn is also the main sweetener, high fructose corn syrup, and corn is turned into all the strange and obscure chemical names on the side of the Twinkies package or any other processed food. Most of those are corn derivatives. So we're eating a vast amount of corn, and if you were to actually look at a lock of your hair or a slip of your fingernail under the right kind of electron microscope and you looked at the carbon isotopes, because we are mostly made of carbon, you would find, I think, that you are substantially the product of corn. That is our diet. Now, why is that bad? Well, in general, we should be diversifying what we eat, and we should be diversifying the land. Diversity is the key to biological health, both, out there and in our bodies, and we're not doing that. But the other reason is to grow all that corn in those giant monocultures takes huge amounts of fossil fuel. When you eat from a corn-based food system, you are eating oil, make no mistake, because the oil is turned into the fertilizer, which the plants depend on, and the oil is also turned into the petrochemical pesticides. All the chemicals used to grow your corn come originally from an oil well somewhere. And we know that's not a sustainable way to eat, especially when, remember, the basis of food chains in nature are always photosynthesis, solar energy. And, of all the parts of our system that could be put on a contemporary diet of sunshine, it's the food system. You know, this is the basis of all food. It's leaves collecting solar energy and carbon dioxide and turning it into carbon, edible carbon, sugars. And the idea that we would turn our back on that to get some gains in efficiency is, you know, will prove to be one of the great historical errors. And so, but the good news is, so yes, that's still happening, and there's, and most of the meat you buy is corn-fed, and a lot of, and any processed food you eat is corn-based. But on the other hand, we have a very vibrant alternative food economy rising in this country right now, and that is very exciting to watch.
You always provide so much food for thought, Michael. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Michael Pollan, celebrating the 10th anniversary of his best-selling book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History in Four Meals. You can learn more about that 10th anniversary edition on our website, wvxu.org. This is The Book Club at 91.7.